Welcome, everybody. Hi, good morning. My name is Margot Smith. I'm director of Kluge Rue Aboriginal Art Collection. Welcome. Before we get started on our program for Art Instead, I'd like to just take a moment and acknowledge and pay my respects and invite you to pay your respects to the traditional owners of this land, the land we're on today. This is Monacan country. And I think it's really important that we remember that this is country that's owned by Indigenous people. So thank you for that. Well, we're here and doing this program, Art Instead, as part of NAIDOC Week. And NAIDOC Week stands for the National Aboriginal and Islander Day of Observance Committee, which is kind of an old fangled title for what used to be a day and is now a week that is intended to celebrate Indigenous Australians, their achievements. There are a lot of festivals that go on in Australia, and because we're the only museum dedicated to Indigenous Australian art in the United States, we also celebrate NAIDOC Week here with programs to bring attention to Indigenous Australians. And so the flag making project is one of those things, and we want you to participate in that if you haven't already. There'll be time to do that after the panel. So before I start talking to the artists as part of the panel, I just want to thank the people who've really made this possible, who've organized our whole program. Holly Zazier, who's our intern this summer and was an intern with us all last year, developed this program really from the ground up. And she worked with Lauren Maupin, who's our education and programs coordinator, and the both of them put so much into this. Of course, the whole Kluge Rue staff has been involved in every step, but also Fenella Bell, who's just been hired here as our museum educator, and so she got thrown right into it from the first day. But we also want to thank Joanna Williams, Laura Henderson, Colette Blount, and Charlene Green, who helped us imagine this program at the beginning and really helped us bring it about. And it changed over time because we had initially planned something quite different for high school students. The result of that failure is that you're all here today and you get to take part in it. So we're really excited about that. Also, you never can do anything in a museum without copious volunteers. So I want to thank all the volunteers who helped today. Kate Williams, Nancy Venable, Nancy Fitch, Ben Wells, Karen Huntington, Melinda Hope, Sydney Collins, Samantha Dreyer, and other helpers in the community, Clarence Green, Terry Snowball, and Tom Kogel, and our partners and sponsors, UVA College Council, Sullivan and Strump, the Embassy of Australia, Australia Council for the Arts, Floor Fashions of Virginia, Ace Biscuit and Barbecue, PhotoWorks, FDS Tents, and Heinz Musitronics. So all of those vendors and organizations and institutions helped us get here today, and we're really thankful. And next, I want to thank our panel of artists. So starting here, Madhavi Reddy and Tony Albert, Frank Walker, and Gerald Knoyer. And I'm going to introduce each of them, but first I'd just like to make a little bit of a statement about what we're doing here today. So this discussion is intended to focus on identity, race, and ethnicity in art. And it just comes to mind that the artists are really going to be speaking from a personal perspective. You know, I don't want to assume that they represent a group or, you know, some collective, because we're asking for their personal experiences and their ideas. The reason we're here is that institutionalized racism is rife in our nation, in our community, in our lives. And I was just looking around on the internet because I couldn't sleep last night. And I was looking at the idea of white privilege. You know, Charlottesville is a wonderful, liberal, open community. But many of us struggle with this idea. And an artist named Naima Lowe made this great installation called 39 Questions for White People. And there are questions like, when did you realize you were white? And I just thought, you know, because those questions never get asked, that tells us quite a bit about this idea of white privilege. So I just want to kind of go into this conversation cognizant of that. And, you know, we're asking our artists who are from different racial or ethnic backgrounds to share their experience. But I don't want to create a kind of us and them experience. So let me start with the introductions of each artist. And we'll start with Madhavi, who's 24 years old. She just saw 23 years old. I just gave her a year. And is a multimedia artist of Indian heritage from Charlottesville. And she, I said earlier to some people, she has the longest association of any of these artists with Kluge Roo because she appeared in our commercials when she was a child. Through her photography, Reddy seeks to share the sentiments of Indian Americans from all over the country. Some of you may have seen her exhibition at the Bridge in March called ABCD, which stands for American Born Confused Desi. And that's what they call Indian kids of American descent. So she'll explain more about that, I'm sure. In 2014, she graduated from American University with a degree in film and media arts and is now working, teaching filmmaking to kids. She gained experience working in journalism with our own Charlottesville Newsplex and shadowed reporters and edited news pieces there. And she's also made a few short films of her own. And I just found out also doing research about Madhavi that she has an ardent interest in Indian classical dance and is very accomplished in this form. And over the years, she's given over 30 performances at various schools and universities in Charlottesville and Washington, at the Indian Embassy, in museums and festivals around the United States and in India. And in June of 2010, she gave her solo graduation performance, which is kind of like, she was telling me, like the black belt in Indian dance, and continues to work in this form of art as well. And one of her aspirations is to create films that promote and preserve the arts and culture of India. And so because I had these in a different order, I have to shuffle my papers. But then we have Tony Albert. And Tony Albert is Australian, was born in Townsville, which is in North Queensland, in 1981. And he has a Bachelor of Visual Arts from the Queensland College of Art. He works in a number of art forms, including drawing, painting, photography, and installation art, which is one of the things he's most known for, and was a founding member of Queensland Indigenous art collective called Proper Now out of Brisbane. And his art explores political, historical, and cultural issues relevant to Indigenous Australians today. He's in the U.S. now with us because he's undertaking a prestigious artist residency in Brooklyn through December. And his work is exhibited nationally in Australia and internationally. He's won a number of awards and prizes, and just in 2014, two very significant awards in Australia within the same week, and a huge commission to create a public artwork in Hyde Park, which is the kind of the central park of Sydney, which honors the military service of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men and women. And Frank Walker was born in 1953 in Charlottesville, attended public schools here during the segregated Jim Crow years, and went to the only all-black Catholic military academy in the United States, St. Emma's in Powhatan, Virginia. And this is from his artist statement, but I learned when he sold his first painting in sixth grade. That's when he found his calling as an artist. And he describes art as a lifelong study. I love that. Perpetual student. And after getting out of the Army, Frank began working as a graphic designer and medical illustrator at UVA Medical Center. He worked for many years as a freelancer and then worked at Northrop Grumman until he retired. But one of his main talents is portraiture. And some of his portraits can be seen around Charlottesville, UVA, and other locations. He has a BFA from Virginia Commonwealth University in painting and printmaking. And his work was shown in numerous exhibitions and most recently at McGuffey Art Center. And his work is also in a number of private collections. So I just want to read this quote from his artist statement. Growing up in the African American community has been the joy of my life. It is that life, regardless of the circumstances, that has shaped and molded me into who I've become. It has taught me that we are put on this earth with certain gifts and that it is to our advantage to use them. What we learn along the way is how we can attempt to perfect those gifts. Those gifts don't make us superior, but they certainly make us exceptional. And then finally, we've got Gerald Conoyer, who was born in 1966 and is a member of the Ogallala Sioux tribe of Pine Ridge, South Dakota. He grew up on the reservation there and after high school enrolled in the Marine Corps for 4 years and then went on to earn degrees from the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe and the Bachelor of Fine Arts and Master of Arts from the University of South Dakota and then an MFA from the University of Oklahoma. And he just told me that he's enrolling in another master's program in arts administration. So talk about a lifelong learner. Love that. His areas of specialization are painting, printmaking, and drawing. And he has over 40 exhibitions to his credit and is represented by galleries in Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, South Dakota, and Italy. And was recently awarded a residency at the Torpedo Factory Art Center in 2014 and the Artist Leadership Program at the National Museum of the American Indian. And I'd just like to read something from him, too. He says, in accordance with Lakota perspective, the repetition of song and prayer brings our people closer to the supernatural beings, which guide throughout our lives. In the paintings, I transmit the importance of repetition in my compositions to induce a trance-like state in the viewer, bringing the soul closer to this particular enlightenment. So let's just have a round of applause for all of our participants. Done a lot of talking. Now I'm going to listen. So the first question I have for each of you, and I guess we'll just go down the line, is how do you identify racially and ethnically, and describe how your art reflects your identity, if you will?
So I think I identify equally as Indian from India as I do American. I was born in India. I was 9 months old when we moved to Charlottesville, but I think in terms of how I've culturally grown up, I'm pretty American, so I identify equally. In terms of artwork, my photography work that I've done in that ABCD life, it voices the opinions and the feelings of people like me who are Indian American, and it seeks to show how we attempt to strike that balance, how we can be confused about where we belong, and what hopes we have to figure out what our identity is. So, if I were, I don't think I could identify as one or the other. I'm definitely both.
Okay. Hello. Hi, my name is Tony. As Margot was saying, I come from far north Queensland. My people are Gidame, Yidanji, Kukulyalanji, and Gugulyimidia. So within Australia, there's over 250 different language groups. I belong to four of those. The main vernacular in Australia is that we're just Aboriginal people, so even in an Australian context, it would be quite rare that people within the mainstream or general Australia would acknowledge us by our individual language group or even know that we have or are different to just a genetic form of saying Aboriginal people. So within an art context within Australia, I'm known as an Aboriginal artist. Unfortunately, we don't kind of sit autonomously outside of that institutional gaze, but I definitely prefer to consider myself a contemporary artist and sit my art practice on a level playing field with that of any other artist working within the industry.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I identify with African American. In my lifetime, I have many hyphenations. I am 62 years old. When I was born, My birth certificate said color. I graduated to a Negro, to Afro-American, then to Black, then to African-American. So I have many names. I have been called Abdullah. I have been called Salim. I have been called Paco. I have been called many names. When I was younger, I had dark curly hair. And so I was more threatening then, and now I'm no longer threatening because I'm bald-headed and my beard is white. But, so I can understand younger men. I grew up in segregation here in Charlottesville. I remember going to Monticello on a school trip. We were never taken by the slave quarters. We were told that slaves were happy people and enjoyed doing what they did. So, as an artist, I came to realize that, especially when I was in medical illustration, that the human body is made up of about 10 trillion cells. You're actually a walking ball of dust. And there is no distinction between one person or another internally. None. Your spleen and your liver and your stomach is all the same color. I do know that. The bones are all the same color. Even in the morgue, when we used to go in the morgue and there was like 40 bodies in there, you couldn't distinguish who was who because they had been in there and everybody was brown. So you couldn't distinguish that. I remember when integration came, it kind of felt like you let the air out of people's tires. Because what happened probably, which was most devastating, is that it sort of removed your culture, where you replace, they took away my James Brown and replaced it with Three Dog Night, Jeremiah is a Bullfrog. And so that was kind of painful because they took away your music. And they sort of took away things, they changed history. We didn't know about history. Our own history until later, that we would, and you would really have to discover a lot of things on your own. For instance, I discovered in my own attic pictures of my uncle's graduation class at Jefferson High School, and which one of the men in his class became a Tuskegee Airman. And so that was very important to discover those things, that they were written about Black pilots. To discover your own history. Art-wise, I came upon this big question when I did a self-portrait, and I did these squares on the board, and when I painted myself, I remember using about 9 different colors to paint myself. And I was going to give this painting to one of my children. But somebody came along in the show, and before I told my children I was going to give them this painting, somebody bought it for a lot of money, so I sold it. Anyway, I took a photograph of it, and so I do have it recorded. But this question has always haunted me, and this is where I always, even to this day, right at this moment, that racism is alive and well, because if I go into an art store to buy some art supplies, and if I was looking for the color of flesh, what is the color of flesh? If I look underneath this tent, every color in here is the color of flesh. So why is there a tube of paint called flesh? And so to make as many portraits as I've done, I know at least every person I've ever painted, be that Black, white, doesn't make any difference. They're made up of about probably 8 to 9 different colors. But if women go into a store and want to buy a pair of pantyhose, if a white woman gets a pair of pantyhose, the color is flesh. What is the color of flesh? If a Black woman wants to buy a pair of pantyhose, she gets raw umber. Burnt sienna. So, you know, when we change the way we look at things, things we look at change. So it's us that needs to change that. And more power to the arts, that we change it through art. And what we see. And what we say. That everybody in here is surely the color of flesh.
Hello, my relatives. I am his mini bears. When I think about the things that have changed within my own life is regarding my cultural heritage, I think of my parents who went to boarding school in the 30s and 40s. They went into the school system knowing their language. In my fourth grade, they did not speak their language any longer. My mother understands Lakota, but she will never speak it. That's the effect that it had on my culture. By the time I was in fifth grade, sixth grade, they started to bring the language back around. But when they taught the language, they walked around with a long stick, and if you didn't say something right, you got a smack on the wrist for not speaking the language properly. We've lost our language, we've lost our land. We knew we were different as a child when you're walking through the streets of the border town. The merchants would treat you differently. You could feel an uneasiness within yourself as a young child. And therefore, you knew you were different. Today, there's a revival on our reservation. At one time, there was more Catholic churches, Protestant, Episcopalian, more churches on our reservation than there were our traditional ceremonial sun dances. Today, that's reversed. The churches are drying up. We pray every single day, but we don't have to go to a church or we don't have to read out of a book to know that the Creator is listening. We don't have to sprinkle ourselves with water and say we are blessed. Waking up in the morning, we offer water to the Creator, to our spirits, spirit helpers. We are one with nature. That's how we keep our culture, our heritage, our language, our songs, our traditions. We hand those down through oral tradition. We have all of these stories, and the stories are slowly changing to keep up with the times that are changing. We have our morals and our ethics within our communities. We go outside of our community and we live by a different set of rules. If we commit a crime on a reservation, it's a federal offense and we go to prison for a long time. If you commit a crime from the state or in the county, it's not that big of a deal. These are the things that I grew up knowing I was different, not being appreciated by the townspeople. When in athletics, when we would have a good basketball team or a good cross-country team, even in track, it was very cold one year in the spring. My brother wore a stocking cap, and he won a regional sprint, 200-meter sprint. He got disqualified because you're wearing a stocking cap. I won state cross country 2 years in a row, and I finished second as a sophomore and fourth as a freshman. Never lost a regional cross country race, and I was never offered a scholarship to run anywhere in the country. Indians cannot learn in the college or university setting. That's the perception. And that's why I'm a lifelong learner. I'm going to get as many degrees as I can. The language is coming back around. My daughter spent 4 years in an immersion program. That's the most learning that she loved, was on the reservation. Everything in the morning from the time you walk in till the time you leave is all in Lakota. Some of her field trips were out to the buffalo pasture. We're out digging timsila. We're out getting cherries. Observing nature, all spoken in Lakota. But when we move out to Maryland, she's a couple years behind in math and reading. So a lot of trips to Sylvan Learning Center caught her up. That's all I have for now.
Let me ask you another question, Gerald, because we, first of all, I heard the crows appreciating you. He has a lot of crows in his artwork, one here and then some things I looked at online as well. And we were talking about that last night. I was just looking at each of you as individual artists. I was looking at your body of work and what you're showing here, and I kind of had a different word for each of you in a way. I'll give you that word, and I'd like to hear your response. So I'll start with Jaelden. The word is spiritual.
Spiritual is, for me, is all about prayer, my spirituality. Everything that I do before I paint, when I wake up in the morning, I say a prayer, I offer water. When I go in to create my work, I will take some sage, I will roll it into a ball, and I'll light it, and I'll wipe my spirit clean with the smoke. I'll add just a little bit of that sage to wipe the spirit of my painting that I'm working on, to wipe that spirit clean. And before I sell a painting or I take it to a show, I wipe the spirit clean of each and every piece before it gets to the gallery. So spirituality is what I base all of my work on.
Thanks, Frank. The word I thought of with your work was sensual. And I don't mean sexual, I mean really the senses. You know, my senses really respond to it.
The people that I love painting people, if you look at the face of a person, they become spiritual, or for instance the little ward I titled 14, and I was drawn to the photograph of him because he was 14 years old and he was the youngest person executed in the United States. He was electrocuted in South Carolina for a crime he didn't commit. That happened in 1944, and he was just exonerated this year of that crime. I looked up on the internet once the images of Jesus Christ, 1,000 images of Jesus Christ. And when I look in people's faces, it has a lot to do with that. Because Jesus Christ was never formally painted. And I believe the reason for that was because no one tribe could actually claim him. And so at the end of that journey, that I realized that if you look in someone's face, and you see love and kindness and forgiveness, then you will see the face of Jesus Christ. And so I think everyone has a spirit, an inner spirit. I noticed that some of the portraits that I do, that if I knew the person, the portrait came out better for some reason. For some reason or another, it was just, I think it was that the spirit connection. You know, it just kind of happens that way. You can, you know, you can feel certain things. I used to work in a funeral home, and I used to do makeup on people before they were put in the casket. And I remember a little girl who had passed away, and it was a very sad story. But anyway, 2 to 3 years down the road, I was given a photograph and asked to paint the portrait of this little girl, and which I did, and I certainly didn't recognize her from being in the funeral home. Well, it turned out to be that same little girl, and I did this portrait for her father, and we titled it "The God Must Have Needed Another Angel," and it was very extremely spiritual. I believe all human beings have this spirit, good or bad. There's something about them that is the inner workings of the soul that you can see, you know. And I enjoy painting it or drawing it. And even as an anatomical artist, people inside, outside, it made no difference. You know, it was all beautiful. If you look at the human body, it is incredible how it was made and designed. You have to know that there's something much greater than yourself that came up with that idea. Yeah.
Thank you. I was thinking political.
Oh my goodness. Political, the life we live. You know, being born Aboriginal in Australia, you enter a life of, you know, what is politics. For a long time, I felt very angry, and rightly so. I think now I've kind of looked and think, that's a very easy emotion to have. It's much easier to tell someone you're angry about something than to actually say you're actually very sad, about the situation we live and exist in, and I think that's more where I'm at now. But and politics is, something incredibly important because of the political life in which we live as people, and that, it's not easy, it's not fair, it challenges us every day. But through that, I'd also like to think, and even with the work like Brothers, there's an underlying sense of optimism attached to it. When I look and work with people like the young boys in the photos, that there are things that hopefully change
life
for the better.
Your mic has gone off.
Sorry,
Lauren is
trying to exit.
Hello? I was finished anyway.
Thank you. And Madhavi, the word that I was thinking for you was self-reflexive.
Well, I think we can universally agree that one of the goals of life is to understand our identity and be self-aware. I think self-awareness is a pretty big goal of life. So that's what I have chosen to focus on for my artwork. And you can see with all the artists, generally when you do art, you tend to do what you know. So I've chosen to focus on my own identity, which is South Asian descent from India, South Asian American, Indian American. And it's a really, really complex identity that takes a long time for South Asians to really understand where they come from. That's where there's a term, ABCD in my title stands for American Born Confused They See. That's the terminology that's given to people like us. And so the work seeks, They See refers to anyone of South Asian descent, by the way. So the work that I do is mainly, the goal is to build that self-awareness or encourage exploration of identity for South Asians, and hopefully that inspires people of other groups. You don't really, identifying your identity doesn't have anything to do with race. It just happens to be what I chose, but it hopefully inspires everyone to think about who they are.
Thanks, and I just want to say there's a lot of crossover in all of your work in those words. Those are just things that I was thinking about in the work that I saw here, and thank you all for explaining more about your work. I think that's really going to be helpful for our discussion. So I was reading an article earlier today, and I would invite everybody to read this article. It's just been on Huffington Post. It's called I, Racist by John Mehta. And it's about kind of the idea of otherness, you know, kind of like what you were saying, that white is the somehow the default or something, or, you know, what color is flesh. And so I was wondering if you individually have felt othered, made other as an artist, in what kind of context you felt othered, and what's your response to that? How do you respond to that? Do you want to start, Frank?
I could probably, when I felt that way, I probably felt othered when I kept silent. And being silent, I remember being inducted into the Army. You're basically stripped of everything, your hair is cut, you know, and you're all marching up this line with nothing but your underwear on, and like cattle. And there's two guys at the end of this desk, and they look at certain people, and depending upon what shade you are, they'll put, you know, black, white, Hispanic, or other. So nobody asked me what I was, and I certainly looked different bald-headed than I did with all the hair I had on my head. So I never said anything. And so I went through that whole fiasco, and I said to myself, what I had learned in that moment was the fact that choose your battles and say what you need to say when it was necessary. And depended upon how you acted, and for instance, I speak English, hip-hop, and Ebonics. It depends on where I go and what I say and who I'm around. Because you can get your face kicked in certain areas. So, you know, just be, I think other was a way of surviving certain things in America. If you... sometimes if you said who you were, I have had people treat me differently. I've had people say things to me that were different. I even had a friend of mine who became a PhD, University of Virginia. He was a good friend of mine. And we used to go watch boxing together. And he would say to me, he said, black fighters were better than white fighters because their skin was tougher and they did not cut as easy. And I thought to myself, here's a very educated man saying that. And so it was interesting to me that, where he grew up was like Corsica, and he moved here with his father. And I don't know if he understood what it was like to really be black or be a minority. Sometimes it's very difficult when you get promoted. There are times, especially when I got the job at the University of Virginia, I had this haircut. And the guy that hired me was a retired Marine colonel. And I had just gotten out of the service. And as I went before him, I kind of stood at attention, which I didn't have to. But I had this great haircut. And I told him where I came from. And he told me he never even looked at my portfolio. He just said, come to work Monday morning. So I don't know if he knew what I was. He just kind of figured I was a soldier and just gotten out of service. And there you go. He kind of knew that my experience was that I would work as military people do. They work until the sun goes down. It's not a question of you get off at 5 o'clock every day. You know, you just go to work and that's it till you get it done. And I guess he kind of felt that and told me to come to work. Yeah, other, it has played a part in my life for sure. For sure.
I think that the most formative experience where I discovered that I was an other was in second grade at Venable Elementary School, where I went from kindergarten to third grade. And I remember one of my classmates asked me just randomly, are you black or are you white? And I didn't really know what to say, so I kind of didn't really say anything because I was neither. I knew I was neither, but I didn't really know where I would fit in. And I guess in the mid-90s, Charlottesville public schools didn't have that many overseas ethnic groups. So it was a really formative experience for me. And from then on, of course, filling out other on SOLs and on different test sheets when they ask about your race has all really stemmed from that one experience where I didn't know what I knew. I was from India. I knew my family was from India, but I didn't really know where I fit in into the American diaspora.
Is that working now? Yep. Other is a really interesting term in an Australian context because other is very different to Aboriginal. Is within Australia, to be the other, I mean, Aboriginal does include that, but then Aboriginal is different to what is other. What you learn in Australia very quickly is there is this chain of, I guess, ethnicity, and where you sit on that is how you relate or work, you know, within a community. And Aboriginal people sit on the lowest rung of that ladder. And, you know, when you come to Australia, you realize how you fit into Australia is you put yourself above Aboriginal people. And that's, you know, that's a key way of fitting in within Australia, is to know where you sit on that ladder and that Aboriginal people sit at the very bottom of it. So for me, when I'm traveling outside of Australia is really amazing because I no longer feel like that lower rung, and I actually fit into different places and have the immense privilege of being able to travel and realize and notice that I'm no longer, you know, to be Aboriginal or to be on the other in different places. There's an elevated sense of being or expectation other people have of you. Yeah.
We've always had a box that said American Indian or Alaskan Native. So. We always have known that we were different and treated as such. It doesn't matter how much education that you do have or what area of expertise you come from. You just know that you are different. Knowing who you are and where you come from is a big part of being Lakota. You have to know who you are, who your relatives are, and knowing your culture. And that's what we hold very closely in our communities. Once you leave the reservation and you go off and you get a degree, or several degrees, you come home, you may not be welcomed back with open arms because you lose your Indian card if you get too educated off the reservation. So I've experienced that a time or two.
So
when Gerald and I were talking last night, he said something that I thought was amazing. We have to talk about it. He said that you can hit the buckskin ceiling. which is the Native American equivalent of the glass ceiling, but in talking about art and art practice as a Native American artist. You know, so basically, can you explain what that means and what your experience was? Maybe tell that story about the contemporary space.
The buckskin ceiling refers to this glass ceiling that we have in Native American art. If you're looking at the big name artists that portray Indian people, their way of life, they can sell paintings for a couple of $100,000 where we only get $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 a painting. There is a huge collection. When I was at the University of Oklahoma, there's a huge collection of all the top Native artists in the country. Alan Hauser, Fritz Schulder, Dan Dominga, Oscar Howe, Kiowa Five. They purchased a painting from me. And they called me and said, "We want you to come and see where the painting is hanging." So I went to the Fred Jones Jr. Museum of Art, and I walked downstairs, and I immediately thought, I'm going to be in the Native American section. So I circled a couple of times. Every step I took, I guess I got angrier and angrier, thinking, where's my painting? And then I walked through this doorway that says 20th Century Modern Masters. So I'm walking in there, I'm walking beeline to get to the exit, and I glance over and I see that Warhol and the Rauschenberg, and then I see my painting. And I thought, wow, I've made it into the modern masters, and I'm no longer considered just a Native artist. So breaking through that buckskin ceiling.
Thanks.
I thought maybe Tony could talk to that subject too, about kind of the separation of the contemporary art and indigenous art, and how you're really crossing, you know, trying to tear down the boundaries.
No, we have a similar thing in Australia. We have a dedicated Aboriginal art department and gallery spaces within institutions, which may sound kind of fine, but in our communities, we call it Darkie's Corner, because you can literally go in into an institution and find the furthest back room or the lowest room within the gallery, and that would be the dedicated Aboriginal art space. So there's no, this is the photography section, and there's, you know, Aboriginal people who are using photography as a tool. Your work will go into the Aboriginal art department. It will actually be purchased with Aboriginal money. So within the institutional categorization of work, say for my work here, the brothers would not be purchased through contemporary art, it would not purchase through photography, and actually they'll make a case for not purchasing your work because they'll say, we don't have to use our money for that, that should be Aboriginal money, to buy that. There's two well-known Aboriginal artists in Australia that refuse for their work to be purchased through Aboriginal art department. So it is creating kind of this larger dialogue within Australia. But it's interesting for me in a curatorial framework, and my colleague Liz spoke about this as a curator, to curate a show under any given premise in Australia really means to me like you need to have an Aboriginal artwork in it. How are you creating a dialogue around a subject without that voice? It's like putting on a show without having a woman artist within it. It's failed before it starts to me, but it's very surprising that thought or that idea doesn't come into curation within Australia. And I'm not sure how it is here, but I would like to see, much greater integration of work because of the, the dialogue that's creating. And, in terms of, we certainly have the idea of the glass ceiling as well. And, my theory is, or belief, I don't want to break the glass ceiling. I actually want to knock the whole building over.
So So for Madhavi and then Frank and the others as well, what impact do you want your art to have, and who is your audience, basically?
Well, I think when it comes to Indian art and India in general, we're so used to that image of the exotic India. We're always thinking about elephants and the artwork and the landscape and temples and Hinduism, and everything is related to India. But we don't really think about the people, this first generation and second generation Indians who live here in our own community. And a big part of my artwork is to expose people to the lives of Indian Americans and what it's like to grow up and try to balance these two very different cultures. There's so much of confusion around it. It's fun, but it's also tough. And a big purpose of my artwork is to get people exposed to that side of the story. Nowadays, I think there is more exploration of the Indian American experience. If anyone visited the Smithsonian last year, there was an exhibit called Beyond Bollywood, which talked about the history of people coming from India to America for the past 100, 200 years. So I think we're making progress in that, and we're stepping away from that exotic India image and looking at it in a more universal, looking at it from a more universal perspective. But the main goal is for the general public, who would be my audience, to really think about what does it mean to be Indian American and what are the differences that they go through.
And Frank, who's your audience and what's your impact to be?
Most of my things are, I think, historically significant. The last show I had, it was called Black Stories. I had a mix of things that had from slavery up until the modern time, depicting various situations of African-American people. Recently, my focus is on African-American women and the American flag. And as I read the book of Douglas Blackman and the book of Michelle Alexander, the New Jim Crow, and the Douglas Blackman book. Also went to see Ta-Nehisi Coates speak. And my strength of that was drawn from African-American women, including my own mother, and those women who I've been creating these women draped in the American flag, black women draped in the American flag, because what had happened to them, for instance, during the peonage years, they would go looking for their husbands or sons, and they would be captured or made slaves themselves in that instance and be used as concubines. I remember a story from out on 29 where Custer came here to and lost the little skirmish battle, but he had his wagon, and he had a concubine, a black concubine, in his wagon. And he left his wagon running from the Confederates, and later on, as military courtesy, they would give him back the wagon and the concubine. They would free the woman from being exploited. And so the strength of black women has been incredible to me, that they would actually work longer than the men. The men would come out of the field during the day, but the woman still had to wash clothes, cook, take care of children, the whole nine yards, have a child the same day, go to work the same day. This was incredible to me. And so the American flag being portrayed in this is that all of these things happened under the American flag. The Confederate flag, long before the Confederate flag came along, here comes this, the American flag already existed. It's slavery, there were more millionaires in Mississippi than anywhere else in the country because of slavery. The Confederate flag, which came down yesterday in South Carolina, and I noticed that they have used the Confederate flag in Germany now because they, after World War II, the Nazi flag was outlawed. It was outlawed to display. You can go 100 yards in any direction in Germany and you'll see a memorial to the Holocaust there. I my next focus is just on women, the power of women. Women are like, they've always worn a red cape of Superman to me, but my mother is a testimony to that. Even when I got too big and I gotten taller and looked down on my mother, she still would put her finger in my face. Matter of fact, I'm going to tell on her now because she's sitting back there in the audience. My mother's the one that sent me to that military academy. And it was a Catholic military academy. We marched into church and worshiped the Lord in a military manner. And so, that just happened. I mean, that was part of life.
I'm envisioning nuns in uniform, but
most of them, there was a sister school up the road, but the priests were very much, I mean, you actually in the mess hall for the first 2 months, you had to sit at attention. If you've ever seen that you had to square your meals off, that you never looked at your food for 2 months. And so that was a Catholic military school. When I actually got to the army, it was a piece of cake.
Tony, you want to go for that one? About your audience and your impact?
I think my audience, I hope my audience is everyone, and the biggest thing within that in my own work is a search for historical truth. The country I come from was never bought, sold, or traded. It was invaded, it was stolen, and that was without introduced diseases or anything. There were close to 1 million people that were just murdered, and yet our education system teaches us that our country was discovered by a white man, and that's still the education system that we have within Australia that, we have to deal with. We have to come to terms. We've got a great saying that you might have here, and that's ignorance is bliss. It's much easier to ignore these issues than to actually have to deal with them, because dealing with them will come with a great amount of hurt and sadness from both sides of the coin, but it's something that just has to happen, and until that acknowledgement exists, we are unable to really go anywhere as a country.
Gerald?
The Native American, or the American Indian, is so glad that Columbus wasn't looking for turkey. My audience, using spirituality as a basis, I get to educate people about the Lakota culture, the thought and the philosophy. I guess I'm making a crossover. Most Indian art shows that you go to or you see or you read about or people collect, they want to collect things that, something out of clay, a jewelry. The paintings they collect are Indian on a horseback with a teepee and the sun and half warrior face, half buffalo, whatever, I don't know. That was cool when I was young. But I learned to go beyond that, and I'm pushing the boundaries as far as what a Native artist can do. And I want to be making a big crossover into, instead of getting a few thousand dollars for a painting, getting the money that other big-name artists are getting.
Okay, I think now's a great time to open it up to some audience questions. And if you two can share a mic, we'll use this mic for questions.
Thank you. This was a wonderful panel discussion. You mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates. And one of the things he writes about in the Atlantic Monthly is reparations. What would reparations look like to each of you?
I don't think America could afford it. you can't replace almost 400 years of 250 years of free labor. You couldn't pay for that. You couldn't pay for it. If I think of reparations, I would think more or less of every minority child in America should get a free education. That would be one way you could pay for it because of denial of so many things. African American people are very economically behind in America for various reasons. For instance, like my father and my uncles were denied after World War II, were denied by banks to not lend the money to buy a home. So the American dream was deferred. So in order to build equity, to start businesses and things of that nature, to send your kids to school was, you know, was just, they were behind. Even though they fought for that, for those rights. So that's the only way I could think of reparations could be established, because I remember correctly, the American government tried to pay the American Indian $5 a month back in the 1800s, 1900s. And what happened was they ran out of money quickly because there were whites coming up and saying, well, you know, I got some Native American in me too. Where's my money? And so, you know, I don't think you can do that with cash, but you can certainly do that with education, you know.
I'm sorry, I can't remember your name.
Does anybody else want to answer that question?
I was just going to say, I think it's 1924, 1925 was when Native Americans or American Indians were considered U.S. citizens. And it was up to each and every individual state to when they would allow that to happen. So I think some states held out until the 60s before they considered their Indian population in their state U.S. citizens.
And I think this really goes for any ethnic group. There are always assumptions made about each ethnic group, there are always stereotypes about each ethnic group, and just making the effort to try and learn about other people, I think that would be good enough, and learn to accept them, that's good enough.
We have a very similar conversation in Australia that you, our country doesn't have enough money to pay, you know, in compensation. I was very lucky recently to do a sculpture in Hyde Park, a monument to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander service men and women. My grandfather went to war in Germany. When Australians return to Australia, they're given land as part of their settlement. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander service men and women weren't given any land. In fact, they're still getting their land taken off them. But what is great about the memorial is the like acknowledgement and visual iconography now that's attached to our country, which positions or gives a memory of Aboriginal people. And I think, you know, our country suffers with what I call a cultural amnesia, like that, you know, these things didn't happen. And the more we can reference Aboriginal people, or the more our landscape can have these signals of Aboriginal existence, I think is a really great thing.
I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, but my question was, during the spring when Charlottesville did the book, The Namesake, how true was that to your experience growing up? And what impacted Charlottesville honoring the Indian community have on you?
So actually, that ABCD Life premiered at the Bridge during the Big Read program. And I think, so your question is, what impact did it have on me? Well, growing up in an elementary school where I was pretty much the only person who was not white, where there wasn't a lot of dialogue about other cultures like we have now, I thought that it was really great that Charlottesville did a program on The Namesake, because it really is. We do have a lot of exploration of other minority groups, but Indian Americans, I feel like, are not always thought of, again, because when people talk about India, it's always about the exotic India. So I was really happy about that. And in terms of the book, The Namesake, that takes place in the... They immigrate to Boston in 1968, and the kids' accounts are growing up in the 70s, which is very, very different, I would say, from growing up today and even in the 90s when I was growing up. But there were similarities, such as, you know, at home your parents might say something in a different way, and then when you go to school and you say it in that accent the way they say it, then, you know, people probably will make a comment about it. There are little things like that that I drew similarities to and will probably continue for Indian Americans from here on.
How has the nature of your art shifted through the course of your doing your creative process?
Is that directed to anyone in particular?
Just to all of us. Anyone who might want to respond.
I don't think my work is... I've sort of always been a realist. I appreciate everything, but I was just more drawn to... because I was an illustrator too, it's very hard for me to shape the kind of doing work that's highly detailed. But I try other things all the time. As a matter of fact, I went just wild one day in the ninth grade and painted this watercolor of a pot of flowers. It wasn't very detailed. And I said, God, this looks awful. And I threw the thing in the trash can. And my teacher pulled it out of the trash can, had it framed, and she sent it to the statewide art show, and it won first place. So maybe I should paint more flowers. I don't know.
Trying to keep up with technology is the next biggest hurdle that a lot of artists are going to be faced with. Everything is going digital. Digital painting, digital drawing. How do you keep up with that?
I guess I haven't really had much time to have a shift since I'm 23 years old. But at this point, my main style, my main focus is to keep my work as realistic and as true to the subjects I photograph as possible. Try to present things as facts. And try to encourage people to introspect as much as possible.
So the issue of assimilation on some levels has come up in different ways in several of your comments. Frank, I was thinking about your statement about integration and how in some ways the process of integration diminished your sense of African-Americanness or blackness in that culture. And then Gerald and Tony, you guys talked about sort of this wanting or needing and having your artwork represented in the wider canon of contemporary art in your communities as being both about acceptance and about it representing the full sort of picture of contemporary art in your communities. And I'm curious about how, as your artwork becomes more and more accepted, how you have a sense of your Aboriginalness or African-Americanness or Nativeness shifting in that in some ways.
Never mind. That was a long question. But I don't know. My focus has always been on telling a story, I think. I'm one of those believers who thinks a picture is worth 1,000 words. Some things need explaining, some things do not. But I'm not one of those people who are probably into the modernization of the digital era, because I am very old school. I love pencil and paper. My mother knew that once we started drawing, my brother and I both, that it would babysit us for hours upon hours. You know, and we would go at that like, and just, you know, we didn't have to have food or water at that point. We just, you know, we just went at it. So I don't know. I kind of teach kids that to learn to draw and draw well, because everything is not in clip art. And you need to produce things sometimes from scratch, and then you can scan it, and then you can manipulate it any way you want to. But there's some people become so reliant, they rely on computers so much that they forget that it is just a tool. You know, there's no computer yet that can match this. This is the ultimate computer. You know, use it. You know, don't let the computer use you. Use it. Let the computer be a tool. I can tell you in my own experience, when retouching photographs with an airbrush, and the photographer knew to give us at least 10 prints because we were going to mess up at least 5 of those just in the beginning. And so when I discovered Photoshop, where I could use an airbrush tool in Photoshop, and when I would mess something up, I could hit edit undo. I think that's one of the greatest tools that any artist could ever, especially graphic people. You know, you can, that edit undo is great. Now, old school, it goes in the trash can and ends up at first place in the show.
I tend to judge the success of my work based upon the quality of life of my people. And I think for me, visual art is the best forum that I can use to help our cause. I grew up with great mentors in my life, one being Richard Bell, who says that he's an activist masquerading as an artist. And I tend to kind of think the same. If I was out on the street yelling my cause, I would probably get arrested. What I can do is put all that into an artwork and be hung in the State or National Gallery of Australia or anywhere else in the world. So for me, it's the best way of getting you know, the message of our people across.
Native people have often been thought of as not deep thinkers. And I want to break that stereotype by, with my studies in astrology, because we had such a strong belief in astrology. We had a strong belief in symbolism. So after reading the book, Power of Myth, I started to do more research with other cultures around the world. And there's a lot of similarities with pattern. And using that, going back and speaking about that. Back home in my community, people don't care about that. They want to see the Indian on horseback. I want to go beyond that. And I want to tell that story to other people around the world and people that appreciate art on a higher level.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
This is a question for the moderator. I'm just curious. There's been a discussion about Aboriginal art being put in the lower level or a room separate from the rest of the art. And I'm just curious about the university's decision to have Aboriginal art in a separate building from their art building on campus. And is there a reason for that, or is there some thought about maybe combining the two. This is a beautiful area, don't get me wrong. This is a gorgeous spot, but I'm just curious, that's all.
Thank you for that question. Okay, so I just will tell you that our being in this building is an artifact of the university accepting this collection of art without an endowment. So basically, we survive on a state budget that gets cut when all of the state budgets get cut, and then whatever else we can raise. And our budget is, you know, like a micro budget compared to, say, the other museum or many other museums that do what we do. We do a lot for the amount of money that we have to work with. But that said, we know that we could serve the university and our community so much better if we were closer to the university, because students won't come here. I mean, there are a few students here, I see you. But it's hard to get them to come here. And many people throughout Charlottesville, when I see them, they say, oh yeah, Kluge Roo, well, I haven't been there yet, you know, because we're on the dark side of the moon. So it's really, you know, it's just a challenge. We do use the space to the best advantage we can with Night at the Museum and programs like this. It's wonderful to have all of this space. But you are only seeing, you know, less than 1% of our collection when you come here. And we could show so much more of artists whose work isn't in our collection. There are many exhibitions that get organized, you know, in Australia, and there's funding for them to travel, but we don't have the space to show them. And there's other exhibitions that have been organized elsewhere of wonderful collections, and we still don't have the either the money or the space to show them. So in answer to your question, we have aspiration to serve all of you and the university much better by moving closer to the university to a bigger space. It's not in the cards just yet, but we're talking about it. So if each of you go home and write a letter to President Sullivan, maybe something will happen fast. This has been wonderful. What a wonderful conversation. And I know some of you want to come up and you'll bowl them over with your own questions, which you may do, but we are going to try and get them some food pretty soon. So, and then you can eat after that.
Everyone could just let the artists get lunch first, because they have to run workshops. So Frank is going to teach you how to draw in our rotating gallery, and you're going to actually get to draw some works from our collection that we don't normally get to show, so that's kind of exciting. Gerald's going to do a workshop. For those of you who signed up for it, unfortunately, it's full now. But for those of you who did sign up for it, it's going to be in the upstairs part, of this wing of the museum. Tony, you're going to make awesome little sculptures from playing cards with Tony. So that will be really fun. That's also a drop-in workshop. And Mahadevi is going to do a photography project with you as well, and that's going to be also in our study center. So if you could just let them get lunch so they can eat before they start teaching you amazing things about art and their own selves, then that would be great. Thanks. Also, if you take any photos at this event, please hashtag art instead so we can keep them all in one place. We'd love to see what you post.